Hi, I'm Dave, I'm an alcoholic. When I got sober, I learned to work the steps early and often. And that got me sober and kept me sober. A few years ago, I ran into a guy that was really doing it. He'd reconstructed all the old stuff the way we used to do it when this program was first started. And that's our secret tonight, Walter. I've had the pleasure of knowing him for a while and hosting him a couple of years in a row now. And the biggest pleasure is I've visited the worldwide headquarters of Back to Basics in Tucson, Arizona. It's a double garage. Okay. And here's Wally Pete, Tucson, Arizona. And he doesn't pull the trigger.
people saw what was going on, and they came over and said, "Man, you're blessed. You just witnessed a miracle." And I said, "Blessed? Hell, I'm cursed." I wanted to die. I wanted it to be over. Once and for all. I was a full-blown alcoholic. I was a full-blown drug addict. I do not talk about drugs and weed and Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in our singleness of purpose. But you can read between the lines on a couple of these things. Came out of Vietnam, could not assimilate back in the United States, ended up in Mexico, living in the jungle for 6 months where people weren't shooting at me on a daily basis. And then I immigrated to Hollywood, California, spent a couple years there trying to get my life together. Then I started doing geographics, did not realize the significance of the PTSD that I carried with me, the depression that I carried with me, the shame and guilt that I carried with me. Never addressed those issues. Took a geographic and ended up in Seattle, Washington, 1973 to 1980. And it was about 1976 that the police pulled me over and they cited me for driving while under the influence. But I don't have a problem. I mean, I'm driving my way out of Georgia Tech. I'm driving my way into a DWI. But I don't have a problem. Alcohol is my solution, it's not my problem. It's the only way I can cope with what's going on out there. It's the only way I can stay at least some semblance of sanity in this insane world that I've returned to. And the instructor gets up and he says to the group of us, he said, "We've been doing this for a while, and statistically, somewhere between 14 and 16 of you that are in this room, of the 20, between 14 and 16 of you are alcoholics." And I'm looking around the room, "Jeez, isn't it bad enough that I took my license away, but now they're going to force me to sit in a room full of alcoholics for a month? I wonder who they are." Well, none of us had driver's licenses, so we found a bar across the street from where we were doing the alcohol awareness school. And at the end of the month, it was something like 14 or 16 of us sitting in the bar trying to figure out who the alcoholics are. Drank for another 12 years after that. Again, alcohol is my solution, wasn't my problem. A couple more geographics. I did get married at that time. I'm honored to have a daughter here tonight. From that marriage, it was a terrible, terrible situation because both of us suffered from the illness. And things just didn't seem to ever go right. Did a couple more geographics, tried to bring my ex-wife and daughter to rebuild the family. We tried it in El Paso, we tried it in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's 1987, and I'm standing in the doorway to the house that I'm renting in Scottsdale, Arizona. And my ex-wife is loading my daughter and her friend from Washington in the car to drive back here. And she tells me, "You'll never see your daughter again." And considering how I was acting at the time, it was the right thing to do. A year later, I'm taking another geographic, and this time it's in Tucson, Arizona. My parents had moved to a little cowboy town up in the mountains outside of Tucson called Patagonia. Yes, there is a Patagonia in the United States. Patagonia. Oh, somebody knows where it is. Yes. Beautiful little town. It's surrounded by a national forest. It's 700 people 40 years ago, 700 people today. It can't grow because of water restraints. And I'm thinking about where to kind of go here one more time, because I'm going to be in Tucson, I'm only 7 miles away now. And I show up at the Big Cedar Bar. And the Big Cedar Bar, just by the name, kind of tells kind of a lower companions kind of place. And I stagger in, I'm drinking all the way down the patio. And there's a new bartender, and I stagger over to the bar, and I said, "You're new here, aren't you?" And she said, "Yes, my name's Sandra, and I'm in Tucson. And I'm filling in for the summer." I said, "Well, my name's Wally, and I'm from Tucson also." And then the shyness kicked in, I couldn't think of anything else to say, and I looked at her, and I said, "That's an amazing piece of jewelry you're wearing. What's that circle and triangle all about?" He said, "This is symbol for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a recovering alcoholic." I said, "Really? I've never met an alcoholic before." I think I would have passed the lie detector on this. I never met anybody in my entire adult life that admitted they were alcoholic. And here she was across the bar, 2.5 years sober, filling me in for the summer, and I just said, "There's something strange, there's something really, really strange about this conversation." Because the next thing she said was, "Well, I am an alcoholic, and what would you like to drink?" I said, "I'll have a Diet Coke." I didn't want her to think that I was an alcoholic. So there I am at the Big Cedar Bar, sitting down in Diet Coke, because I don't want the bartender to think I have a problem. I actually went back to the bar the next afternoon before I started drinking, and we talked. I thought we were both single, we exchanged phone numbers, and she said, "Yes, I will allow you to take me to dinner some night when I'm not working or going to school. In exchange for you attending a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous." I like to say I was 13 steps in AA, but that's not the case. She's 2.5 years sober, she knows the deal, she knows her only job is to take me to a meeting. And that is it. Well, I did take her out to dinner on a Sunday night. It was a miserable experience. It was just all over and didn't go well. I met her in July of 1988, and it's now October. And she calls me and says, "Well, you've been stalling long enough about this meeting. We are going to a meeting next Friday night." So all right, I start drinking again, heavy. And I'm drinking my way to Patagonia, and I end up in my parents' combination rain room and chicken coop in that little mini ranch. 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm slinging down some warm beers before breakfast. It's just me and the chickens. I'm looking down at the chickens are looking up at me. I'm looking down at the chickens are looking up at me. Now, I know what they probably said, which was something like, but I swear, one of those chickens told me, "Wally, this is not social drinking." My last drink in that chicken coop at 7 o'clock in the morning. God sold me through that chicken. I want to be sober to go to this AA meeting, and I got dope sick all week, terrible hangover, shaking, almost PTs, just a bad week. I took the week off from it, but the senator called me here the week and said, "Well, you go to that meeting Friday night?" I said, "Absolutely, Senator. I made a commitment and I'm going to keep it." And she says, "Okay, Friday night's okay." I said, "Yes, except we cannot go to a meeting in Tucson." "Why so? What if somebody sees me there? They might think I'm an alcoholic." She said, "Well, there are open meetings. I don't know anything about AA, open, closed, or any of that." And I said, "No, I am not going to a meeting in Tucson, Arizona." "Okay, let's go to Phoenix." "Oh, no, no, I just live in Scottsdale. 2.4 million people. What if somebody sees me at this meeting? They might think I'm an alcoholic." So the following Friday, after the chicken coop episode, we drove 5.5 hours from Tucson to Sedona so that I could attend a meeting where I felt safe that nobody would know me. Yeah, that's the delusion. You know, I thought I was a middle manager for some Fortune 500 companies. I was. I drank my way out of all these jobs. I drank my way out of 3 Fortune 500 companies as a research chemist. We were walking into this meeting at Stubbs Bearcat in Sedona, and we didn't say anything for 5.5 hours. And I turned to Sandra and said, "You've got to tell me exactly what's going to go on in this meeting. I do not want any surprises." She said, "Nothing's going to go on because you're going to walk in, you're going to sit down, you're going to keep your mouth shut." I can do that. Except I've never been here before. So when somebody read some things, and somebody made some announcements, and somebody did something about chips and medallions, and the person said, "Is there anybody attending a meeting for the first time or in their first 30 days of sobriety? Please raise your hand." "Where's my hand?" "Yes, my name's Wally, and I'm from Tucson, Arizona, and this is my first meeting. Never said I was an alcoholic." Little did I know that at that home group, that was the signal to have a first step meeting. Except they didn't call it a first step meeting, they called it the turning points. We're reading chapter 5 all the time. The turning points that brought each and every person that would be to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard my story again and again and again and again. But I wasn't ready. Not yet. I'm still fighting this to the bitter end. 2 weeks later, Sandra calls me and she says, "I want to take you to another meeting." I said, "No, I've been to my meeting." She said, "No, this is different. This is a speaker meeting. And I want to come over and bring you a book." A book. And she was so coy about it, too. She said, "Do not read anything in the front of this book. The man who's speaking his stories in here is called Dr. Alcoholic Adams, Dr. Paul." It's been renamed in the fourth edition, Acceptance is the Answer. So I read Dr. Paul's story, and I'm going, "Wow, this is pretty cool. He's a medical person, he has a problem, and he thinks that he got some help over these meetings." Interesting. Okay. Friday night, I pick Sandra up, and off we go to the meeting. There's 1,000 people at the Tucson Civic Center. I look at the crowd, I'm definitely afraid of people as a result of what happened in Vietnam. I've never been able to speak in public during this time, ever since that incident in Vietnam. Never been able to feel comfortable in crowds. That's why I became a research chemist, so I didn't have to deal with people. And I said, "I can't go in there, there are no seats." She said, "Watch this." She grabbed me by the arm and she brings me all the way down and puts me on the floor in front of the front of the first row. So I'm looking up the podium and Max, Dr. Paul's wife is the Al-Anon speaker. She did her story. They took a 15-minute break and went where they went and did what they did. I'm still just staring at the podium. And then Dr. Paul comes out, and I got to know Dr. Paul fairly well after this. He said he only did it for a short period of time. But he remembers Tucson, not necessarily remembers me personally, but after he had introduced himself, he said, "Oh, wait a minute, I have to make sure I'm in the right room. Well, all the AAs, please raise your hand." Wham! 800 hands go up. And now I ain't looking around. Oh my God. How about the Al-Anons? Wham! Another 200 hands. And I'm looking around and saying, "Isn't it amazing? I'm the only person in this room that's not an alcoholic in America." Again, I did not come here willingly. And then he leans over the podium, looks down at me, and he says, "And those of you who didn't raise your hand, you're my kind of alcoholic." He spends the whole hour talking about denial. Yes, thank you, Dr. Paul. I consider one of my angels on the ground. I consider Sandra another one of my angels on the ground that saved my life during this period of time. I'm now 60 days in. I've done my two meetings. What I found out from reading this book is an alcoholic without alcohol and an alcoholic without a program has only restlessness, irritability, and discontentment to look forward to. And in 60 days, I hit the wall. I absolutely, totally, completely hit the wall. I would start breaking mad. Double vision, severe headaches, couldn't work. Well, it was between Christmas and New Year's, so I had the time off anyway. I miss Christmas. It's 2 days after Christmas, and I'm still in this terrible, terrible state of affairs. And I called the AA intergroup office in Tucson. And I'm speaking to a guy by the name of John. And I opened with, "I'm not an alcoholic, but what I need is a medical referral because I'm having all the symptoms of somebody that's been on a two-week bender." Now, what a non-alcoholic is about a two-week bender? And he said, "It's 2 days after Christmas, Wally. Normally, we'd send two people out to see you. That's standard operating procedure. But we don't have the staff to do that right now, the volunteers to do that. Can you drive down to the office?" So I had to drove down to the office. And we talked for 2.5 hours, in between him taking phone calls and talking about meetings and where they are, doing administrative work. And after the 2.5 hours, he said, "Oh, we're just about ready to close the office, but I want you to summarize for me, again, all the reasons that you're not alcoholic." "Okay, John, number one, I haven't had a drink in 60 days. Doesn't that prove I'm not an alcoholic?" He said, "I know people that haven't had a drink in years and are still alcoholics. Do you think you can stay sober for a year?" I said, "Hell no, why would I want to?" He's just a monster, right? He said, "How about 90 days? I said, "Does that prove I'm not an alcoholic?" He said, "No, it just proves you can stay sober for 90 days. I said, "I'll think about it." "Why else aren't you an alcoholic?" I said, "John, I've got a big, beautiful car in the driveway there. Look at that. I have a big, beautiful house in the northwest side of Tucson." And the car was a company car that had come to take away. The house was rented. I didn't own. I knew enough about my lifestyle to realize not to have any bridges to burn very quickly as you're moving on. And he said, "Where do you live?" And I gave him my address. He said, "I'm your neighbor, 2 doors down. There's 500,000 people in Tucson, Arizona. I got an alcoholic living 2 doors down." I said, "Geez, I thought it was a good neighborhood." Yeah. degree, I've got a master's degree, and I could never have done that if I was an alcoholic. He said, I don't know about you all, but I am an alcoholic. And he hands me his card. John P., PhD, professor of electrical engineering, University of Arizona, had one more degree than I did, and I'm done. I have run as long and as hard as I could possibly run. I'm done. I made the surrender. I went to the meeting that night. He recommended that I go to a non-smoking meeting because I was not a smoker. And 6 p.m., smoke-free group, and I don't remember the meeting, but after the meeting, somebody comes up to me and says, oh, and I did get my 60-day medallion. I never got anything before that, but I did get a 60-day medallion. And I did say my name is Wally, I'm an alcoholic, the first time ever. And after the meeting, this guy comes up and he says, my name is Phil and I'm your sponsor. I'm here to take you through the 12 steps. Oh, those steps on the wall in the meeting hall. Yes. Okay. I didn't know about any of this, so, you know, 2 meetings, 1 speaker meeting. And he said, yeah, that's my job, to take you through the steps. He said, let me ask you some questions first, and that is, do you have one of these books? I said, yes, I do. He said, have you read it? I said, I've read 1 story in the back. He said, well, that really doesn't count. It's the front of the book that we need to get into. But let me ask you another question. Can you read? Oh, did that upset me? I've got a bachelor's degree, got a master's degree. He said, no. People, when they first come into these rooms, no matter what kind of credentials they have, are going to have a very difficult time reading this book. And most of the time, I read the big book to my sponsors. But since you're so adamant about it, I want to give you a homework assignment. I want you to read page 25. What a way to start your journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. Page 25, there is a solution. I didn't start page 1 and grow up. I probably would throw the book away before I get even halfway through the doctor's opinion. But 25 really fascinated me. And we got together after the meeting the next night. First night, told me some of the stories, so I got to know who he was. The crazy part is that he's 20 years sober. What I learned later is he knows the original program, the program that Dick was talking about, and he's president of an oil refinery. I'm looking at this guy, and he crawled out from under a bridge 20 years ago. It's 20 years later, and he still looks like he just crawled out from under the bridge. What's going on here? Well, come to find out that he was a wildcatter in Bakersfield, and he was beat up and cut up pretty bad, worked at the oil fields of Bakersfield, California. And then he had the scars to prove it. But he was going to take me through the steps. At first night, he said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, no, Phil, I'm here to prove I'm not an alcoholic. He said, I'm still going to take you through the steps. Because it's only a couple hour investment out of my life, whether you make it or not. But he hooked me. He took me to page 52. He took me to the Bedevils. Is your life unmanageable?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you having trouble with personal relationships? Just ask all my ex-wives. Plural. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Just ask all the social 500 companies who are firing me from our alcoholism. We are afraid of misery and depression. Just ask all the psychiatrists that were looking at me. We couldn't make a living. Getting fired all the time. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were happy. We couldn't see I answered yes to all of the above. He said, bingo, your life is a manual when you're taking step 1. I want you to read page 25. Tomorrow we're going to do steps 2 and 3. So I read page 25, and after the meeting, the second night, he said, okay, Wally, what did you read? 2 paragraphs. Show me that you can comprehend something from this book. Fourth dimension. Yes, fourth dimension is in there. Any other two words out of two paragraphs? Anything else? Yeah, God is in there. Oh, you have a problem with God? Yes, I do. Big time. I turned my back on God after I was not killed in Vietnam. I just turned to the darkness and stayed in the darkness for the next 20 years. There's no God in my life. I blame God for Vietnam War. He said, isn't it amazing you don't have to believe in order for this program to work? And the second step book is on page 46. And it reads, we found that as soon as we're able to lay aside prejudice and express even the willingness to believe in the power of greater selves to commence to get results, even though it's impossible for us to fully define and comprehend that power. You don't have to believe. You believe I believe. Yeah, I believe you believe, Bill. 20 years ago, you crawled off under a bridge and I had pressed an oil refinery. Anybody else in the room? Yeah, I think Flint believes. That lady, I don't know her name, but I think she believes. And he said, fine. You're taking the second step on my belief. You see, the original program is you get the newcomer step 12 as quickly as possible to save his or her life. You don't leave them in pain and suffering for weeks and months on end. Yeah, that was the original program. Yes, it was. We're here to mitigate pain. We're not here to create more pain.
Oh, one step a month, no steps for the first year, gotta answer 64 questions on step one.
Some people may know where that came from, but I'll just leave that by. I have some troubles. Okay. So I went through the second step based on Phil's belief. Do you believe or are you willing to believe that there's power greater than yourself? Then we did, and then he says, well, what if you, since you're a non-believer, for the rest of the steps, it's God's you don't understand. So that's how I took the rest of the steps, even the third step prayer. And this guy was a miracle worker, I'll tell you. Phil, definitely a major evil on the ground for me. When we look at page 63 and we look at the prayer, I prayed, and he took out all the these and the vows and the wills. God, as I don't understand you, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me as you will. He brought it down to a level where I felt comfortable. After that, he said, okay, since you're a great reader, yeah, three words out of two paragraphs, I want you to read from the bottom of page 63 to the end of the chapter, and tomorrow night tell me what you read. Next night, we get together. Well, what did you read? It's an inventory. Yes, it is. You got it. How's that inventory coming? It's done. Really, Wally? How so? Ever since I got to AA 3 days ago, I don't have a resentment in the world. He said, well, you've got one now, put my name at the top of the sheet, and we're doing the fifth step tomorrow. I showed up at his house the next night with a blank sheet of paper and his name at the top of it. That was my entire four-step inventory. And this is the inventory that saved my life. Because what I learned from the old-timers and the pioneers, the sponsor did the writing, the newcomer did the talking, he said, this is a perfect four-step, start spilling your guts. So I talked, and he wrote, and he circled some things, and that became my eight-step amends list. And so in about 2 hours, we did set 4, 5, 6, 7, and set up 8, 9. One of the amends I needed to make was to my parents. Bill said, well, when are you going down the patio to see your parents? I'd love to go with you. And I said, I'm going to Saturday. He said, oh, I've got a meeting at the oil refinery. I can't go. And I said, well, he said, said, but call me as soon as the amends is over. So at 2 o'clock, I started up the amends, 2:05, my mom got up and walked out of the room. My nickname growing up was Red. She said, Red, I don't know if this cult is that you joined, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, but you're not an alcoholic. If you're an alcoholic, what is our family going to think? If you're an alcoholic, what are our friends going to think? I'm not putting up with this. I shut up and walked out of the room. So I'm calling Phil at 2:05, and we made a deal to meet in downtown Tucson. He was the first person I saw after the amendment was made, which is again part of the original program. The sponsor is to be the first person in the conversation. You do this together, it's a meat program. It's not a meat program, it's not a diet program. You don't sit home and write an inventory all by yourself alone. You don't make amends alone. Phil was going to drive down to Patagonia and drop me off and then pick me up after the amends. So we could go out to dinner. But the meeting of the order finally got away. Even though my amends was not accepted, I planted a seed. 9 months later, my mom walks into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at 67 years of age, stayed with us for 19 years, passed away at 86 years of age, with a 19-year medallion in her pocket, became the chairperson of the Patagonia group, and traveled with me around the country. Especially from her. I was not allowed to talk to my daughter for 2 years. And I tried to break that a couple times, and Cheryl refused every opportunity for me to make contact with Jennifer. But after I had a 2-year medallion in my pocket, we finally were able to get reconnected. So there's a lot of happy endings along the way here. But at 1 year of sobriety, my sponsor sits me down and says, Wally, I'm not going to be alive much longer. And you remember these two things you may not find necessary to take the drink for the rest of your life, whether I'm here or not. One, if you don't remember your last drink, you haven't taken it. That's why I took it to the chicken coop. And it's not about the date and the time. Many of us are in blackouts, we don't remember the last week. It's don't ever forget how bad it was before you got here. We're great at forgetting. The big book even tells us that on page 24. Very, very important piece. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force of memory and suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. Tells us we are going to forget unless we consciously remember just how bad it was, so we don't ever have to go out there and test the waters again. Second thing he said was, if you don't know where we came from, you'll never know what a miracle this program truly is. I had no idea where we came from, I didn't care. I was a scientist, I'm a chemist with a master's degree in statistics. I don't do history, I don't do sociology, I don't do psychology, I don't do any of this gray stuff, I just want black and white. And Phil sends me off to learn about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. First thing I did was I took a book down off the shelf called Dr. Bob and Good Old Timers. And I'm not reading it, I'm just looking at the pictures. I brought it to my home group in Tucson and I showed it around. Everybody had it, everybody at Dr. Bob's house here. It looks like the photograph was in the 1950s. No. And Phil saw me doing this and he said, well, if you want to find out about Dr. Bob's house, find out for yourself. I'm sure that he meant call Akron to find out if there's a Dr. Bob's house. I got on an airplane and flew to Akron to find out if there's a Dr. Bob's house. I flew on a Saturday night on a red eye out of Tucson and got to Akron at about 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. I called the in-group office and thank God the lady answered the phone and said, it wasn't a Dr. Bob's house until a few years ago, but some members of the fellowship have purchased it, and they're in the process of refurbishing it back to the way it was in the summer of 1935. They have one meeting a year at Dr. Bob's home, and it's this afternoon, and I think he probably might want to go. And I followed her direction, I rented the car, I I drove to the agriculture. She said, "You'd never find Dr. Bob's house on the road." She called ahead. Two people escorted me across town to Dr. Bob's house. Very small house. How many people have been to Dr. Bob's house? Okay, we do have a few. Very small, very unassuming house. They packed 75 people into that house. I don't see how they did it. I'm standing in the doorway. But what they done is they take all the furniture out of the house and they put a table in the living room. And it was a speaker meeting. They had 8 chairs around the table. And the only requirement to speak at that meeting is you had to have 40 years of sobriety. 40. Standing in that doorway for 2.5 hours on November 16, 1989, every person at that table had been sponsored by Dr. Bob. Every single person at that table had been taken through the steps in one day. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have a slow version. It took 4 days to take me through. It's like 4 hours. Oh, it was 4 days. These guys are going through in one day. And they were sponsoring within a week. And I got to meet each and every one of them and get to know each and every one of them. Because I dedicated my life to studying the history of alcoholism, and I was standing in that doorway. This was my 12-step conversion experience. Sue Smith Windows, Dr. Bob's daughter, was serving coffee in the kitchen. I went in and we hid out in there for about an hour, hour and a half, got to know Dr. Bob's daughter. What an honor that was to have her as a friend. She became very close to my mom and to my spiritual guide, James H. Because Phil passed away just a few weeks after he gave me that advice in terms of how to stay sober, whether I'm here or not. I'm studying the history. I called the General Service Office about 6 months later. I talked to Frank M., the GSO archivist. I said, "Frank, how do I become an archivist?" He said, "It's easy. Well, you go down to the office supply store and you get some business cards made up. Put your name on, put an archivist under it. You are one." I didn't know any business. I started to run Arizona with cards with the name Wallet B. Archivist on it. 3 years later, I went to Arizona Air Archivist. Many, many angels on the ground. I'm 2 years sober, and I get reconnected with my daughter. And she wants to know what her dad is doing. So I start taking her on trips to various conferences and conventions where I'm doing archival presentations. And we did this for quite a few years. In 1995, it was May, we were in Dallas, Texas, at a convention called the Gathering of the Eagles. And Smitty, Dr. Bob's son, is the Saturday afternoon speaker. And Smitty gets to the podium and he says, and my job is to introduce all the people with 40 or more years of sobriety on Sunday morning. So I'm the MC for the Sunday morning meeting. And Smitty says, I'd like all the Al-Anons to stand. And I'm looking across the room, and there's Jennifer standing up. And so after the meeting, I go over to her, and I said, "What's going on, Jen?" And she said, "I am now a member of Al-Anon." And I said, "Oh, that's phenomenal. That's great stuff. And I have a sponsor." I said, "Really? It's Smitty, Dr. Bob's son." Whoa! And then she nails me. "Smitty told me something to tell you." And I said, "What is it?" "Stay the hell out of my program." And I yeah, a lot of families are rebuilt because of recovery. I have firsthand experience. I've sponsored a bunch of people through the steps. I do it quickly and often because that's what I was taking through the steps quickly and often. Um, In the year 2000, I get sick and I'm not able to work. I'm so sick. I don't know what's going on. I just know I'm sick. And I take a leave of absence from the company I'm working for, and hospitalized a couple of times. The third hospitalization in 2003, I have run out of insurance, I've run out of money, everything's down to zero, the retirement account is zero, the savings account is zero, the checking account is zero, and I throw myself into the fray by going down to the VA and signing up for medical care at the VA. When I'm hospitalized at the VA, they opened me up and they found it was cancer and it metastasized to stage 4. It was in my abdomen and wrapped around my large intestine, and it looked like it had traveled to my liver. Maybe it was even in my bones. But they gave me 6 months to a year to live. I did get a second opinion and a third opinion. All three opinions, 6 months to a year to live. My oncologist said, at the VA said, why don't you do three things? Why don't you make up your last will and testament? Why don't you clean up the garage? Why don't you take your last trip? I did my last will and testament. I didn't clean out the garage until 5 years ago. I was waiting for that other shoe to fall. But my last trip was a trip up Highway 101 through Oregon and Washington to arrive in Seattle in time to give my daughter's college graduation. That's what the country is all about. Families being reestablished and reconnected. I didn't get sick. I started to feel better. But I did say goodbye to AA in June. It was in Detroit. James H., my spiritual guide, was there, and he told everybody in the room, about 400 people, that he's not retired, he's going to continue to work. But I had to say goodbye. I said, we start the chemo on Thursday. I got to do chemo for 6 months. They said it's going to knock me out totally and completely, and it may not even extend my life for one day, but it's the only thing they knew to do. It's on audio tape. I do have copies of those tapes. And what happened is my plane sat on the tarmac in Detroit for 2 hours. By the time the plane got to Phoenix, the Phoenix to Tucson plane had already taken off. And so they put me up at the Hilton Hotel in Phoenix, Arizona. They don't do that anymore either. I'm walking in the parking lot at 2 o'clock in the morning and I heard a voice, which I call the voice of God. I have come to believe, totally and completely as a result of the steps. And also Phil telling me one thing. He said, well, why are you really thinking about the Vietnam War? God didn't have anything to do with that war. It was just a bunch of selfish, self-centered sons of bitches fighting over the oil deposits in the South China Sea. This is what happens when God is not able to get through to people. Whoa, that changed things. 2 o'clock, Hilton Hotel parking lot, Phoenix, Arizona. Do not let the doctors poison you. You are poisoned in Vietnam. Seek non-toxic treatment for the damage caused by Agent Orange. I do have Agent Orange cancer. It is terminal, it is incurable. All of my friends died in the 80s. I'm the only one left in my company. Third part, seek non-toxic treatment. I am under the care of Andy Wild at the Integrated Medicine Program, University of Arizona. I have taken a holistic approach to my cancer. You were poisoned in Vietnam. What does that mean? Well, go down and find out if they poisoned you. And I did go down and they had me fill out a one-page Agent Orange registry. I sent it in 2 months later. I get a letter saying I'm declared a 100% disabled Vietnam War veteran. And that's what pays for me to make these trips. I am being subsidized by the federal government to be here. So now you know where some of your tax dollars are going. Gave me this opportunity to travel around the world to do this. I made no money for the sale of any literature that has my name on it. This is my gift to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my 12-step work for which I cannot be paid. But I am paid by the federal government to come out here and do this. Thank you. First part, if you cannot let the doctors poison you, I went in on Thursday morning. I sat in two way prayer, but if God can speak to us, God spoke to me. In the Hilton Hotel parking lot at 2 o'clock in the morning in Phoenix, Arizona. And the oncologist is looking up at the ceiling, oh my God, another Vietnam nut case. Writes me up as a non-cooperative patient, refuses conventional treatment for his illness, and says, we're done. There's a bed waiting for the hospice. That bed is still waiting. Because I ended up on over 100 of your prayer lists in 2003. There were people praying for me from one end of this country to the other. And it's your prayers that saved my life, because in October of 2003, I got my fourth opinion, which was the National Cancer Institute, Bethesda, Maryland, and they could not find the cancer, and they still can't find it. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Try to tell me prayer doesn't work. Look in my eyes and try to tell me that. Yes, I have come to believe. I've got many, many more stories to tell, but we're out of time. I want to close. I did get a chance to spend time in Nashville, Tennessee. I did get a chance to meet a family that father of the family was in recovery before he passed, just say Johnny C. I took his daughter, Carlene, through the steps. A good friend that sponsors his son. A lot of recovery in that family. He wrote a song for us in the 1980s, and it's called I Came to Believe. I don't know if you've ever heard some of one of his last album. They've actually released the 1980s version of it in Lost Records of Johnny C. Just came out a couple months ago. But this is how the chorus goes. I came to believe in a power much higher than I came to believe that without him I couldn't get by. In childlike wonder, I gave in and gave him a try. And came to believe in a power much higher than I. Thank you for letting me speak.